CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.
For those of us who still believe a non-capitalist future is both possible and necessary to save the planet, that there can be no socialism without decolonization. The fact is, the genocide persists precisely because the colonial order is still intact. On a global scale, it just takes on a different form or appearance. And so if we're going to fight and try to build that society, that world, we've got to basically understand that the fight against fascism is a fight against colonialism, is a fight against capitalism.
That's Robin D.G. Kelly, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Robin D.G. Kelly on colonialism, capitalism, and fascism. The era of traditional colonialism, with a few exceptions, is over, but it continues in new shapes and forms to have a profound influence and impact on former colonies all over the world. We are in the age of what may be called neocolonialism. Former colonies are simultaneously independent and dependent. Neocolonialism is a more insidious form of imperialism, in which more powerful countries keep developing nations in a state of economic dependence. This dependent relationship is seen primarily in structural inequality, where the rich countries exploit the resources and labor of the poor. Colonialism fostered and institutionalized racist ideologies that continue to manifest in systemic racism. Robin D.G. Kelly says, "It's important to recognize that the consolidation of the modern colonial state and the rise of the fascist state occurred pretty much at the same time. The modern colonial state and the fascist state are both particular forms of capitalist states." Our guest today is Robin D.G. Kelly. He's professor of history at UCLA, a distinguished scholar, and award-winning author. Among his many books are Race Rebels, Thelonious Monk, and Freedom Dreams. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. And now, Robin D.G. Kelly, Colonialism, Capitalism, and Fascism.
What I am is I'm a teacher, I'm a professor, I'm a scholar of history. I'm not ashamed of that fact. I'm a better historian than activist, and I will never be, I'll never pretend to be otherwise. And that means that I spend my time and my life trying to make connections and discovering what is hidden, to comprehend the dialectic. And it's what makes me a Marxist, right? What makes me a Marxist is not the emphasis on political economy. It's not the vulgar materialism that passes off as Marxism. And that means that I can't possibly have all the answers or most of the answers. In fact, I also recognize that there are some things for which there are no apparent answers, either because we haven't studied the question deep enough, or the answers will be determined by the history we make, right? We make answers and struggle. I wanted to use this occasion to recognize the 75th anniversary of Discourse on Colonialism, which is this year. And it just happens to be the 25th anniversary since I contributed the foreword to the monthly review edition. So the book has become very popular right now. Discourse, of course, is best known for tracing the roots of fascism to colonialism. You know, Césaire delivers an unsparing indictment of the West, submitting as evidence a litany of colonial crimes in the form of severed heads and ears, genocide, the epistemic violence of consigning entire populations to being nothing more than beasts of burden, or occupants of land that belong to the civilized or the chosen according to their God. Fascism was the boomerang, right, of colonial violence striking Europe. And Césaire was not alone in making this case. It was made in versions of it were made by Gandhi, Du Bois, George Padmore, Hannah Arendt, Albert Memmi, Jean-Paul Sartre, among others. And the argument, of course, is not universally accepted, primarily because the definition of fascism is hotly contested still. If I had a dime for everyone who's going to be like, well, is it really fascism? I'd be rich. But it's like this still ongoing thing. And I'm telling you, I'm not interested in debating whether or not what we're seeing from the Trump Heritage Foundation state is actual fascism, neo-fascism, no fascism, something else. I will say this, though. Everyone nowadays quotes Langston Hughes' 1936 speech at the U.S. Congress Against War and Fascism, where he said, fascism is a new name for that kind of terror the Negro has always faced in America. Okay? Right. Thank you. But few people include the rest of the quote, which is, this kind of terrorism is extending more and more to groups of peoples whose skins are not black. Sometimes they mention that. And by the way, the quote's not even complete. But that's the part that's not always there. Now, why is this important? Two reasons. One is obvious. It underscores the need for solidarity. But secondly, and this is the important point I want to make, is that that second sentence, it cuts straight to the problem with the fascism debate. Fascism becomes recognizable in the second sentence. That is, the kind of terrorism is extending more and more to groups of people whose skins are not black, whereas the first sentence is considered not fascism. See, that's a problem. Think about it. That's a big problem. And part of what inspired me to sort of think about this, and even my writing on Césaire and Césaire's own writing, is about that first sentence. Césaire exposes the problem with this split, why Hughes' first sentence also defines fascism and why that matters. I'm not going to linger on the colonial roots of fascism, but I'm going to explore like four things. One, the particular role colonies played in buttressing, so-called classical fascism from the 20s to the 40s, as well as the fascist tendencies or state forms coming from so-called liberal democracies. And part of what I'm going to say is that the difference between fascist and liberal democracies is not that sharp. Okay. Second, the role that colonies play in suppressing class struggle. Third, how black radicals in particular came to see anti-fascism and anti-colonialism as sort of one and the same, and the consequences of not doing that. And then finally, and most critically, Césaire's observation that fascism was not defeated in the Second World War, but flourished by way of ongoing colonial expansion. And so think about what are the implications for our times. So I will disappoint you if you think I'm going to literally give you lessons about like what anti-colonial struggle might mean for us. There are some lessons, but some things, what I'm really trying to do is understand this relationship in a deeper sort of way. So first, it's important to recognize that the consolidation of the modern colonial state and the rise of the fascist state occurred pretty much simultaneously. Now think about that. Just to avoid some confusion, because there's always confusion comes with the territory, the modern colonial state, and I mean that modern colonial state and the fascist state are both capitalist states, okay, just particular forms of capitalist states. Modern colonialism is part of a world capitalist system, not solely for the purposes of primary accumulation. And I think Walter Rodney has one of the best quotes about like how he defines fascism, one we don't always use, when he writes in How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, fascism was a monster born of capitalist parents. Fascism came as the end product of centuries of capitalist bestiality, exploitation, domination, and racism, mainly exercised outside Europe. And I wish I could talk like Walter, because if he said it in his Guyanese way, it would be like, you'd be jumping up and down, you know? So with the exception of settler colonies and perhaps India for different reasons, which had a very sophisticated state apparatus before any Europeans showed up, many African colonies did not have a fully functional colonial state until the First World War. This is important, and I know we sometimes take it for granted. We don't think about periodizing colonialism exactly. The point of the colonial state was to create infrastructure for extracting raw materials and produce, but most importantly, to pacify the indigenous population. The colonial state was a coercive state intent on securing territory, crushing opposition, and turning people into peasants and workers. Through what? Through dispossession and enclosure, through systemic taxation, through forced labor, through the introduction of currency for wages and new markets. All colonies had some kind of military force, often made up of indigenous people or settlers, standing police like the Force Publique in Congo. And in fact, during both world wars, according to Walter Rodney, Africa played at least three key roles, right, during the wars. One, to provide a range of raw materials essential for modern arms, and we know this. There would be no atomic bomb without the uranium from Africa. Secondly, to provide bases for European militaries, which it still does. And three, to provide troops and laborers for war. Or to put it another way, European powers use fascism to defeat fascism. Okay? The militarization of colonial life, what made colonialism possible, became foundational to the post-colonial state, right? And decades of violence and coup d'etats and military rule are among the consequences. This is not about tribalism. This is not about backwardness. This is not about barbarism. It's about the colonial state being a militarized state. And that's the foundation for so many post-colonial societies. The militarized state is yet another example of the boomerang effect, one that predates formal fascist rule. So Walter Rodney observes, in World War I, Germany, it was the commander of German forces in East Africa in World War I who actually was brought back to Germany. He was promoted to general and directed the massacre of German communists in Hamburg in 1918. And Rodney calls this a decisive turning point in German history. For once, the most progressive workers had been crushed. The path was clear for the fascist deformation of the future. Therefore, the state and capital also had to do the work of what? Pacifying and disciplining European workers. This is the era of what? The Russian Revolution, the Mexican Revolution, communists and socialists-led workers and uprisings in Germany and Hungary, Italy, and elsewhere. It was also a period of counter-revolution. And who's behind counter-revolution? That includes social democratic regimes, like in Germany. And what does that do? What do? They brutally suppress strikes. They outlawed labor unions. They outlawed left-wing groups. They abandoned democracy and civil liberties under the guise of a state of emergency. What are these? These are the characteristics of fascism. From social democrats. Okay, like I'm saying, the distance is not that sharp. And Clara Mattai has this great book called The Capital Order, and she makes a really persuasive case that during World War I and after, austerity became the capitalist state's method to discipline the working class. And she looks at Italy and the UK. And it also was used to suppress post-war labor rebellions and crush demands for an expanded social wage and to crush socialist dreams. It created a direct path to fascism in Italy. Austerity did. And she writes, austerity embodied the active intervention of the state to reinforce capital accumulation through privatizations, bailouts of financial and industrial complexes, monetary deflation, and especially coercive control of labor. Speaking broadly, the nationalist slant of fascist austerity emerges through the sacrifice of the majority for the saving, investing minority, who purported to represent the interests of the whole nation. So we treat austerity as like a tool in a toolbox, as a, like it's a natural thing. And what she's saying is a weapon, right? And that weapon led to, or opened a pathway for fascism by crushing workers' rebellions. And again, this is in concert with what's happening in the colonies. So in the so-called liberal countries, in this case the UK, it did the same thing, right? Because when it comes to economic policy, there's no democratic means to stop austerity policies. Like, it's not on the vote, right? It's introduced by these people that call themselves economists. They get paid a lot of money. There's some good economists. I know all six of them, you know? So all these like so-called experts, like technocrats, and of course there's no input on the part of working people except how do they input? Through strikes and labor action. Austerity ultimately prevailed as a new common sense, resulting in a general public acceptance that it was a necessary and neutral tool to weather capitalist crises. Okay, so what about the colonies? What's the relationship? Liberal and authoritarian states shared with varying degrees an ideology of racial destiny and a drive for territorial expansion. Again, notice I'm not making a distinction between like the fascist regimes and the liberal ones. They share all that. These colonial ventures were not just economic, but they inculcated workers with nationalism, generating loyalty and softening the blows of austerity. Workers sacrificed for the nation, right? So imagine the implications of workers buying war bonds. That makes no sense. And yet workers were buying war bonds because they had to be convinced, right, to do the work for their nation, to be part of that nation, to love that nation, right, rather than the workers of the world. Let's take the case of Italy. Like much of Europe, Italy ended the First World War in debt, with high unemployment, wave of strikes and working class insurrections, often led by socialists, communists, and anarchists. The Liberal Party ruled, but was losing power and legitimacy at the end of the war. And it chose, as it was losing its power, to collaborate with fascists. Now, they could have collaborated with the Italian Communist Party, but they made a choice. Okay, and okay, so how does this translate? Well, it's kind of like the Democratic Party where recruiting Liz Cheney and military leaders, but undermining Mamdani and Sanders and AOC and so on. It's the same thing. The Liberal Party, Democratic Party, right, undermining the left. But Mussolini was not interested in collaboration. Trade unions called a general strike in 1922. The fascists crushed that strike, marched on Rome, and basically seized power. And the Liberal Party at that point capitulated. Now, Mussolini is in power, and what does he do? He sets out to rebuild the Roman Empire, to restore national pride, to recruit workers to support a colonial venture. So in 1935, this is later, Italy invades Ethiopia. And we know that story, but what I want to emphasize is that even before Mussolini, right, Italy had colonized Libya under the Liberal Party following the Italo-Turkish War of 1911. And it was under the Liberal Party, again, you see the parallels with the Democrats, that Italy's occupying forces gassed and starved Libyans, created concentration camps, ultimately killed one-tenth of the population, consistent with all other imperial countries which waged brutal, often genocidal wars in the colonies. That's France, that's Britain, that's the civilized countries, right? So when Italian occupation forces under Mussolini used mustard gas on Ethiopians in 1935 and killed a quarter of a million Ethiopians within 3 years of the war, bombed Red Cross hospitals and ambulances, who does that? Massacres, prisoners of war, they did not sharply diverge from the Liberal Party's colonial policies. It wasn't a break. Again, I'm trying to get us to think, before we start debating about, you know, should we build an alliance with, and is this really fascism? The line is not that sharp. right? Fundamentally, this is about capitalism in war. You know, another point I want to make is that Western countries were quick to recognize Italy's occupation of Ethiopia as legitimate, and war crimes were ignored until 1940, and that's when, of course, 1940 is when Italy becomes an enemy of the Allies, and they declare war. Otherwise, they would let those crimes go. The invasion of Ethiopia sparked the first stirrings of an anti-fascist movement organized and led by black people. Harlem, you know, they formed the Provisional Committee for the Defense of Ethiopia. Across the country, thousands of black men volunteered to fight. The Garveyite Black Legion established a training camp in upstate New York with 3,000 volunteers. And although Haile Selassie was very problematic in other ways, was pressured by the U.S. to refuse volunteers, the point I want to make here, whether they're when or not, is that these formations understood anti-colonialism and anti-fascism were intertwined. A year later, you know, a couple years later, depending when they go, black anti-fascists turned their attention to the defense of Republican Spain, joining volunteers. And again, they understood the fight against Franco in Spain as simultaneously striking a blow against colonialism. It was retribution for Ethiopia, and it was a blow against racism at home. But I want to return to this question of the international brigades in Spain to underscore the limitations, even the dangers, of anti-fascism without anti-colonialism. Okay, what do I mean by that? Okay, first of all, Moroccans, under Spanish colonialism, made up a substantial proportion of Franco's armies. African-American volunteers noticed the same Spanish loyalists as Republicans who treated them respectfully, right, if not adoringly, spewing racist vitriol against North Africans, right, because they're on Franco's side. It was not entirely surprising, right, because Spain is a place where school children were learning about, you know, about the age of Moorish domination from the 8th century to the 15th century, about how Christian crusades saved Spain and the rest of Europe from this heathen menace to civilization, right? So the Islamophobia was deeply embedded there. Besides that, in loyalist posters, North African troops were depicted as extremely dark. They distorted their image in order to portray the Moors as an evil race of people. So black volunteers and black radical intellectuals, unlike the Spaniards and some of the white, not all of them, but some of the white American comrades in the brigades, came to see North Africans as victims of colonial oppression. In other words, they're on the other side of the war, but they're not seeing them necessarily as like fascists. They're seeing them as being recruited and forced to fight on behalf of fascists because they are colonized. And these are black people who recognize this. So Richard Wright, for example, wrote about this. He sums it up this way. He says, the fascists have duped and defrauded a terribly exploited people. Talk about the North African Moroccans. Langston Hughes, once again, noted the irony of Franco sending Muslim troops on a crusade to rid Christian Spain of communism. Which, think about that, right? And he writes, I knew that Spain once belonged to the Moors, a colored people ranging from light dark to dark white. Now the Moors have come again to Spain with the fascist armies as cannon fodder for Franco. So some radicals called on the Republican government of Spain, the Popular Front, to grant independence to North Africa. In fact, they were saying, grant independence to all your colonies under Spanish rule, arguing that such a measure not only had political merit, but it would, in effect, undercut Franco's forces. But they would not. The Spanish government did not. It wouldn't go as far as ending colonialism. In fact, it went further the other way by offering territorial concessions to France and Britain in exchange for Western support, which they really didn't get. The Communist Party of Spain and the PUM, which is the Anti-Stalinist Workers' Party of Unification, believed that an explicit anti-colonial policy might actually foment rebellion within the ranks of Franco's army, but they supported the government's position, and so for the sake of maintaining the Popular Front, they didn't say anything. The Spanish Socialist Workers' Party was outright, we'll never give up the colonies. Like, why call yourself socialist? Like, you know, I'm looking at this. So my point here is that, you know, so many people on the left who are fighting against fascism could not see that the same regime was upholding and maintaining fascism, right, through colonialism. So many international brigaders started calling North African troops, quote, things like the scum of the earth, black riffraff, and mercenaries, to which George Padmore, a black radical, wrote a rebuke in 1938. He says, it seems rather strange that the people who use these epithets conveniently forget that these unfortunate Africans are as much the victims of a social system as Europeans who are forced by sheer economic necessity into the armed forces of the capitalist states and used by the imperialists to shoot down unarmed and defenseless natives in the colonies in the name of democracy and law and order. See, that is the critique right there. Right? So he placed, you know, the blame on the Popular Front government for continuing to hold on to the colonies, and colonialism is precisely what made it possible for Franco to mobilize the army. Okay. In any case, the other thing that César was keenly aware of is that fascism was not defeated at the end of the Second World War. So César explicitly references the atrocities carried out by French occupation forces against the anti-colonial movements in Vietnam and Madagascar after World War II as evidence of fascism's persistence. And I just want to quote, he says, think of it, 90,000 dead in Madagascar, Indochina trampled underfoot, crushed to bits, assassinated, tortures brought back from the depths of the Middle Ages. And of course, when he talks about Madagascar, he's referring to the massacre of the Malagasy people by French occupation forces in 1947 during an anti-colonial uprising. And you know who was there to help put down the uprising? Troops from Senegal. We have to know this history. So before the publication of Discourse on Colonialism in 1950, post-war anti-colonial and anti-racist movements insisted that the victory over fascism was incomplete. So, some examples. 1945, this is South Africa, 3 years before the Afrikaner-led National Party came to power and imposed apartheid. The non-European unity movement issued a statement arguing that non-white South Africans continue to live, quote, under a tyranny with very little different from Nazism. And by the way, people in government were themselves Nazis. They weren't like pretend Nazis, they were actual Nazis. Many colonial wars broke out around the time of Discourse's publication. Notice I call them colonial wars. I don't want to call them anti-colonial wars. Why is that? Because by calling them colonial wars, it signals that the instigator of the war were not those fighting for their freedom. They didn't instigate the war, right? They assumed their basic right to freedom in this new global order that says you got a right to freedom. So if they fight back, it's because the war had been waged on them before their birth. It had been waged on them from the moment of colonial domination, right? Algeria, they wanted to hold on to Kenya. They want to hold on to Vietnam, to the Congo, to southern Rhodesia, which outlawed all African nationalist parties, and the fascist Rhodesian Front, a party of settlers, won a majority of seats in the legislature when? In 1962, it's the year I was born, 2 years after the Year of Africa. So again, fascists are coming to power, not people who look like or sound like, but declare themselves, right, as part of this fascist movement. And there are many more examples, but none in the post-war period is as striking as the creation of Israel.